just to discover that they share a unique characteristic. This is that the square of the short side, 3 units by 3 units equals 9 units, added to the square of the median side, 4 units by 4 units equals 16 units, together result in a figure equal to the square of the long side, 5 units by 5 units equals 25 units, in other words, the sum of 9 plus 16. The real secret magic of the triangle, however, as the Icelandic mathematician Einar Pálsson has pointed out, is only revealed when the numbers are cubed. Then we get 3 by 3 by 3 equals 27, 4 by 4 by 4 equals 64, 5 by 5 by 5 equals 125. The total of 27 plus 64 plus 125 is 216. And as the reader will recall from earlier chapters, 216 is one of the sequence of numbers identified by historians of science Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend as being derived from precise observations of the precession of the equinoxes, those long-term changes in the sky that unfold at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. Numbers derived from this precessional sequence turn out to be encoded in ancient myths and monuments all around the world, tracing their origins back to what Santillana and von Deschend can only conclude was some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization of prehistoric antiquity that first dared to understand the world as created according to number, measure, and weight. The heartbeat of the cycle, as we've seen, is 72, the number of years required for the unfolding of 1 degree of precessional change. In observational terms, a 1 degree shift over 72 years, effectively an entire human lifetime, is barely perceptible, being roughly equivalent to the width of a forefinger held up towards the horizon. A 30-degree shift through one entire zodiacal constellation requiring 30 by 72 equals 2,160 years to complete is impossible to miss. But its progression could only be precisely recorded and noted by many generations of conscientious and accurate observers. A 60-degree shift, in other words, through 2 zodiacal constellations, takes 4,320 years, 2,160 times 2 equals 4,320, which is why a 360-degree shift, all 12 zodiacal constellations, the great year, requires a grand total of 25,920 years. Within the precessional code, as Santillana and von Deschend showed conclusively, it is permissible to divide and multiply the heartbeat number of 72, the number of years required for 1 degree of precessional change. This is done in myths and monuments all around the world, for example at Angkor in Cambodia, as we saw in Chapter 12, and at Borobudur in Indonesia, as we will see in Chapter 18. Thus, 216 is 3 times 72, or 2,160 divided by 10. Its derivation from the 3-4-5 triangle inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid is therefore most unlikely to be an accident, and the relationship of all this to astronomy and geodesy, earth measuring, is clear. This is further confirmed by the external dimensions of the Great Pyramid, which, as I showed in Fingerprints of the Gods, encode the dimensions of our planet on the precessional scale of 1 to 43,200. Essentially, if you measure the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, you get the polar radius of the Earth. And if you measure the base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, you get the equatorial circumference of the Earth. The fact that 43,200 is one of the sequence of precessional numbers identified by Santillana and von Deschend further reduces the likelihood of coincidence and requires us to take seriously the proposition that we are indeed looking at part of the intellectual legacy of some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization that had measured the Earth and observed the changes in the stars with scientific accuracy long before what we understand as history began. So to return to Harran, James Q. Jacobs' discovery certainly suggests that the founders of this city made a deliberate geodetic choice when they set it at latitude 36.87 degrees north. What adds to this impression is that Jacobs has also found a geodetic relationship between Harran and the fabled Mesopotamian city of Ur, with which it was known to have enjoyed a close relationship in antiquity. The history myth of Mesopotamia, Jacob says, holds that Ur and Haran are two important related Sumerian centers, both associated with the moon. I checked the latitude of the Ur ziggurat at 30.963 degrees. At first, I did not notice co-latitude equals 5 over 3 arctangent, atan. Co-latitude is the distance to the nearest pole, a geodetic reference point. Latitude references the equator, the mid-pole's plane perpendicular to the rotation axis. The local level plane at Haran intersects the rotation axis at 4 over 3 atan angle, forming a 3-4-5 right triangle, as does latitude in relation to the equator and geodetic center. Summarizing, co-latitude at Haran equals 4 over 3 atan and at Ur 5 over 3 atan. This latitude at Haran equals 3 over 4 atan and at Ur 3 over 5 atan. Perhaps these idolaters were doing astronomy. I would go further and say undoubtedly the Sabian star worshippers of Haran were doing astronomy. And given the evidence we've reviewed in chapters 14 and 15 for precise calculations of precession by the makers of Göbekli Tepe, so precise that they were able to create a symbolic picture of the winter solstice sky in our own epoch, 11,600 years in the future, I'm not surprised by further evidence in this region of extremely ancient and extremely precise scientific astronomy and geodesy. This evidence goes far beyond the capabilities normally attributed to the historical civilization of Mesopotamia. And because it draws back the veil, requiring us to look very deeply into prehistory, it again raises the specter of a lost civilization. Jacobs has noticed this and admits to being puzzled by it. His final discovery of relevance here concerns the geodetic relationship between Göbekli Tepe and Haran. The sites, says Jacobs, are apparently indivisible, just over 40 kilometers apart. The difference in latitude from Haran to Göbekli Tepe equals precisely 1/1000th of Earth's circumference. This is where we enter a twilight zone in ancient astronomy. Of course, the opposite metaphor, the dawn of ancient astronomy, is the proper one regarding the implication. Göbekli Tepe features the oldest known room aligned north-south, evidence of astronomy in practice. Even non-archaeos, Jacobs continues, understand stratification and deposition basics. Deeper is older. Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old. Haran is equated with Ur of Sumeria, the civilized land and a cradle of civilization. That cradle and astronomy is presumed to be 4,000 to 5,000 years old, not 12,000. Haran is located at 3 over 4 atan latitude, a fixed parameter, and Göbekli Tepe is at a specific latitude difference north. Because the fixed parameter must come first, the conundrum, of course, is that this precise 1/1000th of circumference latitude difference is either a coincidence or ancient astronomy just took a leap back to 12,000 years ago. My understanding is that Jacobs is no fan of alternative history, and he has commented forthrightly on the amount of utterly unbelievable pseudoscience that is presently in circulation on the internet and in the media concerning Göbekli Tepe. Kudos to him, therefore, for going where the genuine science takes him and keeping an open mind to the possibility that ancient astronomy and precise Earth measuring may indeed go back much further into the twilight zone than mainstream archaeology has hitherto supposed. The Magi of Haran. As Haran was in its beginning, a center of the exact sciences, as Jacobs proposes, so it continued to be throughout the millennia when the Sabians practiced their star worship here. As late as the 9th century AD, Albertani, better known in the West as Albertegnius, arguably the most distinguished astronomer and mathematician of the Middle Ages, was born in Haran and went on during a long and distinguished life to record many remarkable scientific achievements. Of particular note, combining both exact astronomy and exact geodesy, was his calculation of the greatest distance of the moon from the Earth. Since the moon's orbit is elliptical, it has both a perigee, the point at which it is closest to the Earth, and an apogee, the point at which it is furthest away. Al-Battani's estimate of the moon's distance at apogee was within 0.6% of the modern value. He is also noted for his calculation of the length of the solar year at 365 days, 5 hours, 46 minutes and 24 seconds, an error of only 2 minutes 22 seconds when compared with the figure produced by modern astronomers with the benefit of advanced technology. Al-Battani catalogued 489 stars, produced more accurate measurements of the sun's path than Copernicus would achieve 600 years later, and gave important trigonometric formulae for right triangles, a fact of the history of science that is perhaps noteworthy in view of the relationship of Haran's latitude to right 3-4-5 triangles discussed above. Al-Battani's full name, which includes a number of revealing epithets, was Abu Abdallah Al-Battani ibn Jabir ibn Sinan al-Raqi al-Harani al-Sabi. The origin of the epithet Al-Battani itself is unknown, but is conjectured to refer to a street or district of Haran, his birth city, from whence Al-Harani is of course also derived. Al-Raqi refers to the city of Al-Raqqa on the Euphrates River in Syria, where Al-Battani spent much of his working life. Most interesting, however, is the epithet Al-Sabi, which according to the authoritative Dictionary of Scientific Biography indicates that Al-Battani's ancestors, if not he himself, had professed the religion of the Haranian Sabians, in which a considerable amount of the ancient Mesopotamian astral theology and star lore appears to have been preserved, and which, tolerated by the Muslim rulers, survived until the middle of the 11th century. The fact that Al-Battani's elder contemporary, the great mathematician and astronomer Thabit ibn Qurra, hailed from the same region and still adhered to the Sabian religion seems indicative of the keen interest in astronomy that characterized even this last phase of Mesopotamian star idolatry. Thabit ibn Qurra, AD 836 to 901, and also born in Haran, would have had little patience with loaded terms like star idolatry, which seek to place the paganism of the Sabians on a lower level than the deadly and often bigoted, narrow-minded and unscientific clerical monotheism of religions like Christianity, Judaism and Islam. Thabit was well aware that underlying the ancient Sabian practices misunderstood by these young religions as star idolatry were indeed exact sciences of great benefit to mankind, and thus he wrote, "Who else have civilized the world and built the cities, if not the nobles and kings of paganism? Who else have set in order the harbors and rivers, and who else have taught the hidden wisdom? To whom else has the deity revealed itself, given oracles, and told about the future, if not the famous men amongst the pagans? The pagans have made known all this. They have discovered the art of healing the soul, and they have also made known the art of healing the body. They have filled the earth with settled forms of government, and with wisdom, which is the highest good. Without paganism, the world would be empty and miserable." To the above should be added that even this translation fails to do justice to what Thabit was attempting to convey here. The Syriac word hanputho that he used in his original text, and that is translated above as paganism, in fact means the pure religion. Its cognate in Arabic is the word hanif, which appears in the Quran, referencing ancient pre-Islamic faiths that were regarded as pure and thus not to be persecuted. Indeed, the Sabians were accorded recognition by many leading thinkers in the early centuries of Islam as the archetypal Hanifs, and this, together with their famous claim to be a people of the book, was amongst the reasons why they were left free for so long to practice the old ways. We've already seen how the Sabians were allowed to build a new temple of the moon god and to continue their religious rites after the Arab general Ibn Ghanem conquered Haran in the 7th century AD. This in itself is a sign of most unusual favor, since Islamic armies normally offered pagans the choice of either conversion or death. Even more interesting, however, is the Sabians' encounter with the Abbasid caliph Abu Ja'far Abdullah al-Ma'mun, who passed through their city in AD 830 and reportedly quizzed them intensively on their religion. Remembering the Sabian pilgrimages to Giza, It is reasonable to wonder whether there is any connection with the fact that in AD 820, a decade before he visited Haran, it was Mamun who tunneled into the Great Pyramid and opened its previously hidden passageways and chambers. Indeed, it is through Mamun's hole that visitors still enter the monument today. Described by Gibbon as a prince of rare learning, it seems Mamun's investigation was prompted by information he'd received about the Great Pyramid. Specifically, that it contained a secret chamber with maps and tables of the celestial and terrestrial spheres. Although they were said to have been made in the remote past, they were supposed to be of great accuracy. Like his father, Harun al-Rashid of Arabian Nights fame, Mamun belonged to a line of learned and open-minded caliphs. By the 11th century, however, when the last temple of the moon god in Haran was finally destroyed, a new, more fundamentalist and far less tolerant faction had seized the reins of Islam, and the suppression of the pure religion of the Sabians began in earnest. We know they continued to make their pilgrimages to Giza until the 13th century, but after that, they disappear from history, and while some scholars feel that elements of their faith survive amongst such sects as the Mandeans and the Yazidis of Iraq, who themselves have been subjected to intense Islamic persecution in modern times, there seems to be no trace left of the Sabians today, except for one tantalizing and intriguing thought. The Sacred Book of the Sabians was the compilation of texts now known as the Hermetica, a copy of which most mysteriously found its way into the hands of Leonardo da Pistoia, an agent of Cosimo de' Medici, founder of the Medici political dynasty of Florence. It was 1460, and Pistoia was traveling in Macedonia at the time, but immediately returned to Florence with the treasure of ancient wisdom that he had acquired. With equal speed, Cosimo ordered his adopted son Marsilio Ficino to delay translation of the complete works of Plato on which he had just begun, and to translate the Hermetica instead. It was, as the late Dame Frances Yates, one of the world's leading experts on the Renaissance, has observed, an extraordinary situation. Indeed so, particularly since there is much to suggest that it was this introduction of Hermetic ideas into 15th century Europe that kicked the Renaissance into high gear and gave birth to the modern world. Or was it, perhaps, not so much the birth of a new world as it was the rebirth, the resurrection in the language of the Edfu texts, of the former world of the gods? Signs of the Hands. As we have seen, the Edfu texts speak of the seven sages, bringers of wisdom to mankind, teachers of science and magic. The Mesopotamian texts also speak of seven sages, the Apkalus, whose functions are identical to those of their Egyptian counterparts. We have explored all this in earlier chapters and need not repeat ourselves here. What I was unaware of, however, until I began to investigate the traditions of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jubilees, and elsewhere, is that scholars have discovered close links between the Watchers and the Apkalus. For example, figurines of Apkalus were buried in boxes in the foundation deposits in Mesopotamian buildings in order to avert evil. The term Masare, Watchers, is used of these sets. Likewise, the Apkalus were said to have taught antediluvian sciences to humanity, and so too were the Watchers. As one scholar concludes, however, the Jewish authors often inverted the Mesopotamian intellectual traditions with the intention of showing the superiority of their own cultural foundations. Thus, the antediluvian sages, the Mesopotamian Apkalus, were demonized as the sons of God and appear as the Watchers, illegitimate teachers of humankind before the flood. All in all, what this body of research reveals is a series of links between the Watchers and the Apkalus, so close that they might reasonably be supposed to be two different names or titles for the same beings. There is neither space nor need here to explore this material with all its multiple interconnections in any further detail. But I find it tempting to imagine that it might be these very beings, these Watchers, these sages, who are depicted on the tall megalithic pillars at Göbekli Tepe. Notwithstanding their resemblance to the symbols of Mesopotamian deities, the presence of the bag-like objects on the upper register of pillar 43 in